death date, and I was back there 2.5 years, and mine came up, and I heard a prison guard coming down the walkway, and I thought they were coming for me that because it was my day. But really, they give you this yellow piece of paper that says that you've had a stay of execution pending Ohio Supreme Court decision. And it was just you were always on edge, you know. It was just a terrible situation to be in, you know, thinking that, you know, you could be dead any day now, you know. It was just a horrible situation.
So the state almost took your life. They did take 40 years of your life. Will you be compensated?
I have no idea, ma'am. It's a long process. Mr. Howell could probably answer that question better than I could.
Well, Brian, you have 10 seconds.
Well, it is a long road. You know, certainly I think he deserves something for the 40 years that was taken from him, but that's something that we'll just have to see as things move forward.
It's amazing already $43,000 has been raised just from people who care about you, Ricky Jackson. We will continue to follow to see what the state will do. Ricky Jackson has just been released from prison after 39 years for a crime he did not commit. Longest held man who's now been exonerated. His lawyer, Brian Howe, a staff attorney with the Ohio Innocence Project. Happy holidays to you both. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like a copy, go to our website at democracynow.org. Our specials this week will be Noam Chomsky for an hour and Isabel Allende. Tune in. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:02. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with our host, Paul Rowland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Triangle Productions run of Five Lesbians Eating Quiche, starting November 28th and ending on December 20th at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. This is a comedic look at the window of 1956's Susan B. Anthony Society for the Sisters of Gertrude Stein, as they sit in their renovated community center, sharing secrets as the threat of atomic apocalypse nibbles at their heels. Again, that's the Triangle Productions performance of Five Lesbians Eating Quiche at The Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO at the Clinton, a monthly film screening at the Clinton Street Theater, is proud to show Five Broken Cameras on Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. The first ever Palestinian film to be nominated for Best Documentary Feature, Five Broken Cameras is a deeply personal first-hand account of life and nonviolent resistance in a West Bank village surrounded by Israeli settlements. Shot by Palestinian farmer Ahmad Burnat, who brought his first camera in 2005 to record the birth of his youngest son, the film is structured in chapters around the destruction of each one of Bernat's cameras. Again, that's Five Broken Cameras, Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And good morning. You are listening to KBO Community Radio, coming at you out of our studios in Southeast Portland. My name is Paul, and this is Wednesday Talk Radio. And that was Steve Earle with The Revolution Starts Now from his CD, The Same Name. And what you heard right after that was, boy, I forgot to get her name, a Filipino woman from a local organization at the rally last night in response to the lack of indictment against Darren Wilson, the killer of Mike Brown in Ferguson, which has elicited such outrage across the country. And that rally happened on the steps of the so-called Justice Center downtown Portland between 4 and 5:30 or so, after which there was a march. And some people might have heard there was an after march that continued on after that, that I participated in for a while. I've been talking about reform or revolution in various ways for months now, sometimes more overtly, sometimes less so. And we're going to, I guess, continue on that theme from a variety of angles. Number to call is 503-231-8187. So what does it mean, the only solution is revolution? What does revolution mean? What could a revolution look like in this country? Heck, what does reform mean? I don't know. These are things we, you know, really have to think for ourselves in these dire times when it just seems like we are so overly determined by the force of the police, the military, the institutional and economic arrangements that don't allow us much of a chance to truly express ourselves, despite, you know, brief moments like Occupy, where people once again took over the public space. To some extent, of course, the public spaces are continually being eroded, privatized, controlled, taken over by a corporate state nexus. So one thing I wanted to talk about was a really interesting moment that kind of led to the after march at the Injustice Center in downtown Portland, where the event was winding down and some younger people started to express their desire to not let it just end there with a bunch of speeches and everybody go home. People were really wanting to call for something more. What that could be was not determined. But so there was a little bit of a conflict between, I'd say, you know, the older, more established organizers of the event and some of the younger people in front there. And so the organizers started to sing We Shall Overcome, and there was even some, you know, pushback to that, where people felt that that wasn't really an appropriate, I guess you could say, I don't want to speak for anybody, but that was my feeling, response to the urgency that people were feeling about the continued killing of young African American and other people of color, and white people too, by the police around this country, and the need to take stronger action. And so that was a really interesting moment, and it did lead to a break off a group that then started their own chants, continuing the main chant of the march, which was no justice, no peace, or what do we want justice, when do we want it now? And it seemed like most of the people on the march, or maybe half, I don't know, there was, I think, well over 1,000 people. It was quite a large crowd. It was a really intensely energetic crowd last night. If anybody was there and noticed these things that I'm talking about, has your own ideas about it, I'd really like to hear from you. So anyway, the crowd then marched through Portland, was at the intersection of Burnside, walked over the Burnside Bridge, Well, no. First was at the entrance to the west side of the Morrison Bridge. There's a little bit of a scuffle with the police there. Turned back, marched through downtown, walked across the Burnside Bridge. We're in the middle of the Burnside Bridge for a while. Then we're at the end of the Burnside Bridge at the intersection of Martin Luther King. Held that for, I don't know, 20 minutes, half an hour, and marched down along the east side, inner east side, and back up, and then tried. Some people got onto the freeway. I guess it's the on-ramp to 84. I'm a little confused about this. And blocked traffic for a short time there. There's probably 50 people on. Then started to, there is kind of a dangerous situation. There's a lot of, there's the like about half a dozen police on horseback, number of motorcycle police, bicycle police. There's a number of riot police there. And there are some pretty serious altercations with the police there. The police ended up taking back the freeway and pushing people off. There were some scuffles. I noticed it seemed like a police motorcycle had been pushed over. And then people went up the stairs to the Morrison Bridge and took that over and marched across that. And then this older fellow, myself, with a slightly weak ankle, these are all my excuses, having to do a radio show the next day, which I'm doing now. I opted out around 8, but then I hear a lot more happened. I guess people went on back on the Morrison Bridge, number of arrests, something I heard a report. I don't necessarily want to credit these reports because I wasn't there, but objects were perhaps thrown at the police, I understand. Anyway, it got a little more heated. So if anybody wants to anonymously or not talk about your experiences there or what you think about these things, this whole, there seems to be something of a generational tension, conflict going on around the country. I heard that in Ferguson as well. Sort of the older established African-American groups were being pushed back against by younger people who wanted to do some things differently, didn't want to just, you know, use the same old channels, the same old slogans, I guess. So that seems to be going on around the country. There seems to be a desire to push things further, that things are really not changing. So I don't know. These are, it's an interesting time, and I'm interested to hear what other people say. And I also am going to talk a little bit about Why We Can't Wait by Martin Luther King, which came out 50 years ago this past July, and I think is extremely still relevant to what's going on. I also want to talk about some articles you can find on the internet about how it's incredibly rare for a grand jury to do what Ferguson's grand jury just did, that is, not indict someone. It's extremely rare when a grand jury of any kind is called and no indictment is brought. When a prosecutor wants an indictment, they usually get their indictment. So it seems like something else was going on with that grand jury, that perhaps it was a show to basically try to resolve the issue in the grand jury and not have it go to court. So let's go to our first caller with that. Tom, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for the discussion. I was there at the protest last night, the first one, and was equally frustrated and angry with the decision in Ferguson. But a lot of the second group that broke off, I noticed a lot of kind of problematic views earlier in the night. A lot of those people who at the end were up there yelling at the leadership were advocating for violence, and they were saying we need to fight the police, we need to do it, and that's why there was kind of the decision to ask people to leave, was because there was an advocation for violence from those people, as well as there was violence that happened. There were some motorists who were attacked, innocent people. There was a guy who was punched. There was some stuff that happened that innocent people got attacked as well.
Are you sure about this?
Yes, I read those reports. And
read those reports where?
The Oregonian reported let's
hold on. You know, the Oregonian is not necessarily the most trustworthy source.
They had photographs of the guy. They had, I know other people who were there who saw it. And I know that before they started, they were calling for violence.
Well, photographs of what guy are you talking about?
The guy who was punched.
Do you know the circumstances around that?
He was a motorist in a car who was honking because his car was blocked. And
I'm prepared to believe this account, but I also heard someone say at the margin, I'm not defending or blaming anybody in particular. I just think we have to be careful in these circumstances when things get really hot and heavy. That I understood if we're talking about the same motorist, that motorist actually started to accelerate into some people who were in front of it, and so that was the reason there was a heated response to that. Justified,
I don't want to speculate on all of that. I just want to say that.
Well, but you are saying things, and I'm just sort of pushing back and trying to complete.
Correct. I just want to. But earlier in the night, a lot of those people who were trying to organize that second march were calling for violence. I was specifically interacting with some of them, and they were saying, we need to fight. We need to do something different. And they were criticizing. And here's the major problem is that, a predominant number of those people at the end of the first protest were white, standing there yelling at black leadership, telling them that what they were doing was not good enough.
I was right there too, and I'm not sure that's actually necessarily an accurate depiction. The one person specifically who was yelling most, we don't want to get into personal details, I believe was not actually white. And then I know some of the people who really led the broke off were actually, there's several young African Americans, specifically the one who held the megaphone. The reality was it was an overwhelmingly white march, the whole thing, because Portland is an overwhelmingly white city.
I think
the percentage of people in the breakaway march the percentage of non-white to white remained pretty much the same, I would say.
Correct. And then in the paper and from other people who I know who are criticizing the leadership, saying they're just people who want to hear themselves speak, is a huge discredit to the leadership, specifically Dr. Leroy Haynes, who was just recently inducted into the Portland State Civil Rights Hall of Fame, who was hugely involved in the civil rights movement in the 60s, who the AMA has been largely instrumental and involved in the DOJ suit against the police. They're huge activists in the community.
They've
been largely fighting against police. And then a couple of Portland liberals who want to do more and want to have an excuse to yell F the police all of a sudden are saying, oh no, all they want to do is talk. But they don't understand the history and the legacy of these people and how, yes, they're speaking on the steps of the Justice Center, but that is backed up by a lifetime of dedication to civil rights and movement. And we have a lot of younger people who are coming in who don't know that history and that legacy. We have a lot of younger white liberals who don't know that history and that legacy, and they want to fight in their way, but they don't understand that people like Leroy Haynes and Dr. Bethel and a lot of the people that were up there speaking, they've been involved in this for a long, long time, and they actually have done a ton. And for a group of people to be criticizing them for only standing up there speaking do a huge discredit to the work that they have done, and it's largely frustrating.
No, I respect what you're saying, and I think that I feel the tension on both sides, but I also, I don't want to minimize the importance of these generational shifts as well, because those people you're talking about themselves were younger people in the 60s, and they had some of the same tension with the older generation at the time. So I think these are important dynamics that we should try to close them in any boxes, I guess is what I'm saying, whether it's violence, nonviolence, or, these are issues that have to be worked out in practice.
Correct. I understand that. And I don't mean to say the second group shouldn't have split off and they shouldn't have shut down the freeways. I'm all for disruption. I'm all for agitation. But there was some kind of problematic views, especially in the calling of nonviolence, which no matter what, I will have to say that I don't believe in any protest that promotes or calls for violence. Number one, because Mike Brown's parents have asked, if you are in our protest, please do not use violence. So it dishonors the request of the very family you're fighting for.
Well, it goes way beyond the family of Mike Brown, obviously. I mean, I'm just a white guy sitting here in Portland, Oregon. So I just have to sort of acknowledge that. But I do, you know, it does seem like what's the frustration that's being expressed is being expressed for the rampant lack of accountability in police departments across the country, Portland included.
Correct. And part of that accountability, though, is that the police are using violence.
Right.
So when we use violence in response, then we are only another group of people speaking the language of violence, which is the thing we're trying to fight.
Right. Well, there's various views on that. And I would like to encourage people to express their views on that and all these other questions I've raised. And I noticed there's a couple other callers, and I would like to keep talking to people, and we just can't really do it, to be fair to others. So thanks for calling. I appreciate that.
Oh, no, thank you for your time.
Okay. So let's just go right to our next caller. Joanne, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, I've been knowing for a long time something different has to be done, but I don't have the know-how about it. And in the 1990s, when I was active in different things, I used to get annoyed at some of these established leaders, whatever, privately. But at the same time, we have to be aware of police, FBI infiltrators, and that word I can't pronounce, agent provocateurs or something, and I'll get off the line, listen to your program.
Okay, well, thank you. I mean, yeah, I mean, there was one, I mean, there were incidents there where people thought, oh, maybe that was an agent provocateur. I don't know. It's really hard to tell in the heat. There's sometimes it's more obvious. I don't know. That is an ongoing concern, and people who are involved in more intense forms of interaction, shall we say, with the authorities always need to be cognizant of that. And I didn't see any strong evidence of anything like that last night. I saw, I saw a fairly disciplined, what seemed like fairly disciplined march. Of course, I'm not advocating for anything in particular. I'm really describing what was going on. I was there as a journalist. Of course, you know, you're participating because you're there with everybody else. There's a lot to be talked about. Let's go to our next caller. Jackson, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty good.
Joanne made a very good point. Correct me if I'm wrong. In France, before anyone is allowed to do any type of protest, they have to sign paperwork and go through a process signing, saying that they're not agent provocateurs. And
I have no idea about that. That sounds kind of unusual. I would doubt that that's the case, but I don't know.
Yeah, I remember hearing something like this by Roger, the gentleman that made that movie Roger and Me, Michael Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And we live in a post-internet world, so as a result, everyone's going to be connected. And as a result of this connection, we're going to have simultaneous protests like we did last night across the United States. It's not like the old days when the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. And I'm saying that I believe that there is a real possibility for a lot of these very real protests to be discredited. And I think it's very important that when we are protesting, we're keenly aware that we understand how dark the dark side goes when it comes to these things. And the word would not exist, agent provocateur. These people in one movie that was made by Michael Moore, they discovered that there was a gentleman who was in their group protesting with them who did work with the police department there. And I just think it's an issue that has to be acknowledged as these protests really start to make progress. Because, I mean, you know, be careful about what you wish for, because you just might get it. And the point I'm trying to make is at some point, these protests will start to make some type of progress. And when they do, watch what happens as far as the discreditation of the groups. And as I just feel like Americans are so naive when it comes up to government, what government's capable of doing. That's all. So that's all I have to say. And thank you for your time.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling. And our number is 503-231-8187. The lines are open. So I would rather talk to you than hear myself talk. I've got a couple articles I'd like to read from at some point. And again, talk about why we can't wait and why it's so timely. Yeah, the question of effectiveness, what is really effective, what direction to go in to become really effective. Again, what I consider a fundamental question, reform or revolution, is it? You know, I've talked a lot from a lot of different angles about how the present system that we are trapped in actually has us trapped, so that, you know, whether it's the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which basically makes it illegal to move towards sustainability, also makes it the institutions that were created in the process of colonization of this continent and the imposition of an alien social order on the indigenous people, and the basically long legacy of elite rule over the masses that was basically incorporated into our system of governance, and the delegating of authority to others to make decisions, combined with a capitalist economic system which privileges those with landed property initially, and then the ability to translate having landed property towards control over mineral and other resources to accumulate that wealth, and the ability to exploit, and of course the slavery, chattel slavery, which was another form of property ownership, which is another way that people accumulated the wealth. And then, of course, the rampant theft of the indigenous lands, which allowed this all to begin with. I don't think many of us have not really come to grips with what the nature of this social, cultural, political, economic system actually is, and how it has fairly easily co-opted attempts to change, resist it. And that's what I call reform. I think reform tends to not get at the roots of what its power is based upon. And so then the idea of actually calling for revolution is problematic, because then you get into, especially when you're doing it on air, you get into questions, serious legal questions. So I am very careful to try to phrase my language in a particular way, because you can't call for the violent overthrow of the government, which is one reason why people shy away from violence, I think. And I think for very principled moral reasons and very good reasons, because I do believe also that that does play into the hands of the authorities. So these are all very complicated questions. And often we don't really address them because they are so thorny and complicated. And I think the best way to address them is not necessarily over the air. We don't really have time. What we need are to get ourselves in smaller forums and study groups where we can really hash this out together, because alone it's very difficult to confront these things. These are some of the issues I've been trying to get across that I feel very strongly about, and I think it's good to talk about them. I think this is one important place to do it in Portland, talk radio, because there aren't many forums. So with that, we do all of a sudden have two more callers. Steve, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I'm listening to this in depth, and I just want to share briefly history. Born and raised in Portland, 53 years old, honorable discharge veteran, been in prison in 1990 during the enhanced incarceration, war on drugs, all this stuff. And the interesting theme that I'm hearing today that I really support and appreciate what I just heard you say, passion about speaking, bringing people together and having discussion. I think two most important things are in this fabric that are being sidetracked. One being violence, the other being experience. It is the youth that needs to get out in the street and do something, as the youth are sitting in front of these people at the Justice Center last night that are in their senior seasons, calling for nonviolence, but yet the very ones want to describe little certain incidences about violence and then say that's wrong. Let's redirect where the violence is initiated from. How about the United States over the last 8 years blatantly going to other nations and committing violence to promote what the American system is about, and then we stand and have a grievance to express we're tired of law enforcement abuse and violence, but yet when somebody here does violence, we want to talk about that instead of the hundreds of thousands of people that have been killed in other countries by U.S. policy.
Yeah.
So at one hand, we do need violence to combat violence, but in a way that stands in truth. See, children of light that stand in truth don't participate in darkness. So one thing I really appreciate with the clergy leadership last night coming, but also the Bible teaches your children of the light or children of the darkness. Children of the darkness don't participate in the things of the light because the light exposes them. Therefore, the children of the light should not be out in the dark because they're practicing and participating amongst the evil that participate in the dark. And violence is always going to happen until the white man tells the truth about colonization, about murder of indigenous people that they want to tell a different story about. Read the book, The People's Story of the United States, and talk about how the white people came here, colonized, and have murdered with violence innocent people in its origin. And then let's discuss the minimal violence that is being displayed in the city by people that have rocks and bottles versus people that are militarized and follow instructions of the white shadow government. So let's not talk about the little guy that got punched in the face last night, because that's a mere distraction of the big picture.
Okay. Well, thank you for that perspective. Appreciate that. Thanks for calling to KB. Is that, are you still there?
Yeah.
Yeah, anything else?
No, I hope that I wasn't insultive or offensive, and I hope that I spoke clearly in a way that's considerate to all my brothers.
All right. Well, thank you very much. I think that's a view that is important to hear, and the whole idea of monopoly of violence by the state, the structural violence, institutional structural violence that is endemic. This capitalist economic system is violent, does violence every day, every minute against us, forces us into terrible choices that we have to make to basically, I believe, reduce our humanity and reduce others' humanity by participating in it. Do violence against the earth constantly. And it is so much easier to look at, individual acts in the heat of the moment, and I'm not excusing, blaming, trying to assign any judgment on it. And in some circumstances, it could be, as an earlier call, it is sometimes provocateurs who are trying to discredit. And so that's a it's complicated. These things aren't easy to, and that's why people do shy away from participating in these things. It does help.
Can I say something?
Yeah, sure. Okay.
That's really awesome. I want to speak on provocateurism. Okay, in the United States military at 18 years old, I was trained to carry out missions with the Special Forces, 2nd 75th Airborne Rangers as a combat medic. We were taught to not look suspicious. So I want to talk about that provocateur shit. We have a bunch of people that are assuming positions of authority wearing badges that haven't got a clue of performing the task of security. We see it all over the place, men standing outside of banks with weapons. We're calling for weapons in schools. I mean, we're still doing the same things we were doing back in the 60s, and the thing that's baffling is these are educated people that have all this collective data that can show who's responsible for the dire turn, yet we will not allow them to be held accountable and just say, like they would say to any other average citizen, look, you're fired, pack your bags, leave your office. We've made it so complicated to protect them. We have made our police force a gang. It is now representative of a Bloods and a Crips gang, only it's a police gang fighting a now disarmed population and then complaining because they're being violent against them.
Okay,
isn't
I get it.
Isn't that insane?
Yeah, we have a couple more people on the line, and I have to give everybody a chance. I really appreciate your saying it. Before you go, I just you said a word that we had to press our dump button, and I really want to encourage people to be really conscious of the language that they use. Usually we just cut people off when they use that kind of language, but I thought you had some really important things to say. Just to anybody who calls in, you know, we really can't use certain language on the air. We risk very seriously if we let that go out. So thank you for calling.
I'm sorry, I didn't know. I was caught up in the passion because, like I said, man, I'd been there.
Okay, well, thank you for calling. And I just want to, before we go to our next caller, coming up later this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, Glenn Greenwald interviews James Risen, the New York Times Pulitzer Prize winner, about the government's attempt to imprison him. And later in the hour, we hear another reaction to the failure to indict police officer Darren Wilson from law professor Vernelia Randall. At 10, Eric Cascadia is off today. We'll hear Flashpoints featuring American Indian Movement founder Bill Means speaking out against the racist use of Indian culture and names by professional sports teams. And 11 on the Recovery Zone, professor and writer Mark Beekhoff talks about our need to reconnect with our natural landscapes and with animals. Thank you, KBOO members, for all your support you give in various ways. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. With that, we have a couple more callers. Guy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thanks.
Good morning.
Actually, I'd like to just start, if I could, just by thanking Steve for his service. And I think that the voice of the veterans is so powerful right now, especially speaking to the militarization of the police. This is kind of a uniform thing that we keep hearing, that the guys who are on patrol in Iraq or in Afghanistan, this is not the way to interact with the people that you're actually meant to protect. But I kind of want to go a little further with that, and you know, you were talking about you know, police kind of turning into a gang. I think that this, and my hope, and this is kind of what I wanted to get on the air and say, because I have this hope that the protests and the media attention and the uproar, the furor, the anger, the grief, the humanity of this reaction will split the police, will begin to cause some fissures in that blue wall. We started to see that. There are some police officers that have been outspoken for justice. So my hope is that this will kind of help to improve that kind of wall mentality, us against them. I imagine, I don't know if other people have experiences or want to speak to that later on, that's fine. That's kind of all I really wanted to say this morning. Go ahead.
No, I agree with you. I think, you know, there's a classic sort of political analysis of revolutionary situations, which we are certainly not in, but you know, it always helps if elements of the police and the military are on your side.
Well, sure, and I mean, we're talking really ultimately at a level of mental health. I mean, this isn't a healthy environment for the police either. It's dehumanizing for them as well. I mean, this is just not the way. I'm sure it would. I can't speak to it. I'm not a police officer. But the general kind of climate in the country is so antagonistic and it's a dehumanizing situation for them, I imagine, as well. Alienating. I'm concerned for their mental health. I'm concerned for the mental health of anybody that can do these things. So, you know, that's in a situation where they feel that they have to shoot an unarmed person 12 times or beat someone to death. It's not healthy. It's not healthy.
No, I think we're in a deranged society, and yeah. The institutions are themselves deranged, as I tried to outline from the very get-go, and I think yep. we really need to come to terms with that.
And yet, even within these systems and within that systemic derangement, there are individuals that are suffering, and even the individuals that are being called upon to be the force of that institution are suffering themselves. I don't know whether they know it or not, but nobody needs to live this way.
No, thank you. I believe that too, and I try to say that. And there's a lot of people who don't really like to hear that, and
right.
I understand them too. But I feel it's a more nuanced. I guess I would even venture to say possibly mature perspective, maybe, but even that is kind of judgmental. So I'd like to leave it at that, and yes. Thank you for calling.
Thank you.
And again, the number is 503-231-8187, and we have Tom on the air.
How you doing, man?
All right.
I hate that there's no end to money for overtime for all the cops that have been on duty in Ferguson and here, and there's no end of the amount of money for all the riot gear and all the crap and all the BS, and you know, we can't find any money ever for our schools. You know, that really pisses me off. Are you there?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well.
Be careful with our language here. I agree. I mean, how can you not but agree that it's a very sick set of priorities that we have? And talking about it is one thing. I personally felt during the observing the march last night, the march and the aftermarch, the march itself was, you know, your usual, it was good to be together. I think it's really important. I think it's important to include everybody, in the in what we're doing as hopefully we're building towards something. So I think the different moments are really important. And the background is what you're talking about. But when we come up against it, some people would say that the protesters themselves are the ones who are causing that to happen. And so you're getting a lot of people who think that way. And that kinds to split us too, because, you know, people are at very different places in terms of looking at these things. And so we try to get out certain perspectives here on KBOO. I share your perspective, and I do believe that it is necessary to do things to kind of force the issue, as it were, because left to its own devices, this machine, out of control machine that's spending so much money for wars and armaments and militarization of police, is not really going to change. So, you know, there does tend to be this blaming the victim. There was actually someone who called up on a talk radio yesterday at the very end and said that, why don't people just get over it, basically, that, you know, the past is the past. And, we should just move on, basically. And I think what I'm trying to say is that the armored mentality that is manifested in all this excess weaponry and armaments is a reflection of the armed mentality that was established in this country from the very beginning. Anyway, that's very long. You go ahead. Maybe you have something else to say.
Well, I'm listening too. That's good. I mean, there's so many things to be said about all this. I really, personally, I hate my tax dollars being wasted on all this crap. You know, there's that the very first protest at Ferguson, you know, they showed up, the cops showed up with an armored vehicle with a machine gun on the top of it. Who did they think they were facing there? They were facing, at worst, somebody with a picket sign. You know, and as far as FBI infiltrators, of course there's FBI infiltrators. There's no reason to believe every single fire in Ferguson wasn't set by an FBI person. I mean, there's every reason to believe it was somebody from the FBI, as there's as much evidence as it was any citizen of that lives there. I mean, there's no evidence of who did it, you know. And we know the FBI, I mean, J. Edgar Hoover, I mean, and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and it goes on and on. I hope the people in Ferguson listen to Malcolm X a little bit and, you know, self-determination. Don't burn your own places down. You know, they're...
Yeah.
I mean, if I had to choose between places to burn down, I mean, I would... I'm not that person either, and I'm never going to be that person, but, you know, look at the most oppressive, most greediest, you know, say, for example, something Mart or whatever, that the heirs have as much wealth as, six people have as much wealth as 78% of the blacks in America.
Yeah, I heard that too. You know,
and if nothing's done, there's going to be a revolution, because the division just keeps getting wider. They keep getting more militant. So I guess the revolution will look like something like when we went into Vietnam, you know. You know, the guys will be in all their riot gear, and the North Vietnamese will be hiding in the tunnels and shit, and stuff. Excuse me. You know, I mean, I don't know what the future is going to be, but it's going to, if it keeps going how it is, I mean, the corporations are Nestle's trying to take over our water.
All right, well, we got a couple other callers. We got a couple other
prisons, and I mean, it's just all gone run amok. We need to change something. There needs to be revolution.
All right, we got another couple callers. Thank you very much. Appreciate your calling. Who we got next, Steve? Red Willow, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The thoughts that I have to share, and then one request, perhaps, of the station there to consider. I think that as long as we keep looking at people as other, even these policemen are not other. We need to find the intersection point, all agree on our humanity and build on that. The thoughts, you can't discourage thoughts, but you know, the whole way of thinking of someone as other as being unacceptable. And then my request is, there's been some really good stuff happening with Anonymous and the KKK. I'd like to hear more about that on the station.
Okay.
That's about all I had to say.
Okay. Well,
bye.
Thank you very much. Yeah, no, I think, I guess that's, I actually don't have anything to say about that right now, but I have heard something about Anonymous calling out KKK members, I guess, is what you're referring to. And it's 8:48 here on your community radio station, KBOO. My name's Paul. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I would just encourage, I keep talking about this, but go to Wikipedia, Why We Can't Wait. It's written in published in 1964, based on Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail. Describes 1963 as the beginning of the Negro Revolution. Of course, Negro is out of use for many decades. Seeks to describe the historical events that led up to this revolution and to explain why this revolution was nonviolent. King seeks to describe this history because of how quickly it is importance to events to come. Until it strikes, the Negro Revolution generated quite years of humiliation, abuse, and deprivation. Because there is more to come, the spectacle of the Negro, I should just say of the black people or African Americans in revolt, Because the dimensions are vast and the implications deep in a nation with 20 million African Americans, it is important to understand the history that is being made today. King gives several reasons why the Negro Revolution erupted in 1963. Disillusionment with a slow speed of school desegregation after Brown versus Board. Lack of confidence in politicians and government, particularly after the perceived failures of the Kennedy administration. You could add in Clinton, Bush, Obama, but especially Clinton and Obama, because they're Democrats supposedly on our side. These include a weak stance in housing discrimination, and a lack of support for black voting rights in the South. Ditto for today. Decolonization of Africa. It's really hard to understand now the incredible importance that played. There is just such a really different world at that time, where things seem like they're really rapidly changing and shifting. But the decolonization process still continues, must continue, I add. The Great Depression never ended for African Americans. This is, again, why 1963, why we can't wait. While others enjoyed an economic recovery, black unemployment rose. Again, echo of today. King says that economic inequality in America became particularly obvious in 1963. So true. So that's an interesting little synopsis from Wikipedia on why we can't wait. And with that, we've got another caller. Richard, you're on the air.
Good morning. I have a few things to say, so if I could just say them, then if you have a response, that's cool. But I'd like to remind people that our Chief Justice, he wasn't a Chief Justice, but our Supreme Court Justice, Charles McNary, in 1914, ruled that the will of the people is crystallized in the acts of the legislature. That has never been overturned. It is the basis for dozens and dozens of cases that have all been winners since then, and I want people to be aware of it. And then here's the thing that we could do if we were people enough, if we had the balls to do it. We don't wait, but we assert our will, and the legislature crystallizes it. This is it. The prerogative of the people to pick their police shall be inviolate. That's all I had to say.
What was that last phrase? Sorry, repeat that again.
Right. The prerogative, the ability of the people to choose, the prerogative of the people to pick their police shall be inviolate.
Well, yeah.
If we are really people, if our will is what the legislature acts upon, then why don't we do this?
Okay.
Instead of saying, why are they doing it to us? Why don't we shift our consciousness to say, oh, why don't we do this?
Well, yeah, I mean, but the idea that the legislature is the vehicle for the will of the people, I think we must problematize that, to use certain modern lingo, because it is obvious that the system was set up to be rigged. Not to say that we shouldn't work through that. And as you know, there's the idea of dual power, that we continue to act within the constituted institutions, flawed as they may be. But we also must work outside of those institutions, hence protests on the street. And how this is all going to work out, how these are interplayed. I think the point of, you know, picking the police, I mean, maybe a more fundamental question is, why do we actually need police? What is the origins of the police as an institution? And do we really need police as they've been developed in this society? I think those are even more fundamental questions.
I'm totally into that. And people, if people would devote themselves like they have devoted themselves to the recent get-togethers that we're calling riots, if that energy were directed toward we only have 90 legislators in Oregon, but if we would devote it to the legislatures of the various states, we could choose when. After that law was passed, we could choose to have two cops per 5,000 people or 10,000, or we could choose to have as few or as many as we needed, as we deem necessary. But the power, the prerogative of the people has to be held up. We have to say we're the people, we have the prerogative. It is our prerogative. We live here.
Okay, well,
the
fair enough.
The legislature is ours. Okay, all right, thanks.
Yeah, thank you for calling. Yeah, I mean, the question always remains is how do we translate these relatively dispersed and disorganized feelings, desires, expressions of discontent, of wanting something better, how do we actually make them concrete? And Ajamu Umi, who I interviewed for a live news report yesterday evening, is constantly emphasizing the need to join organizations, to create organizations, and to create networks of organizations. And I, again, going back to the original point that I brought up about this generational conflict, I certainly meant no disrespect for the organizers of the march. I think it was very, of the rally in March, I think it was very important that all those different groups were together. And I think something is developing, but I think there will be tensions. And I think a lot of times they do happen along generational lines. And I think what is the role of the older established institutions, including KBOO, including the various groups that were organizing that march? I was not a participant in the organization. Like I say, I'm just a white guy talking on the radio. Try to do my best to bring views that I think are important, to let people speak, to create a platform. But I do believe that something does seem to be have the possibility of shifting, and that does often seem to happen along generational lines. It certainly was true in the 1960s. It's true with Occupy. I think it's really important that we try to work these things out, and that we don't let the generational conflicts become divisive conflicts, that we understand how to be good guides if we're older people, and how to also listen if we're younger people, but not necessarily follow along if people are not expressing what we feel most strongly. Hope I said that somewhat coherently. Anyway, that's what I was feeling from yesterday. We are pretty much out of time. I want to re-give my email address. I've been out of town. I was out of town for 4 or 5 days. Haven't been able to see my email recently. I apologize to the people who've written me, actually, some of you for several weeks, so I haven't gotten back to. I am going to try to get on that. Paul R. KBOO, all lower caps, at gmail.com. That's the email address. If you would like to be in contact with me and carry on some of these great ideas that people have been expressing about how to get people together, how to help organize through these airwaves. Thank you so much for listening. You are listening to KBOO Portland. I was walking down the street in the town where I was born. I was moving to a beat that I never felt before. So I opened up my eyes and I took a look around. I saw you written across the sky.
Thanksgiving is a time to give thanks. But for many, the problematic history of the creation of this holiday casts a shadow on what Thanksgiving is supposed to represent. On Thanksgiving morning, on KBOO, we bring you Indigenous Voices on a Colonial Holiday. Tune in from 8 a.m. to noon for a series of special public affairs programs, including a conversation with local activist and founding member of Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry, Jacqueline Keeler. We will also hear the voices of Dr. David Lewis and Dr. Michael Yellowbird. We'll talk about history, politics, education, food, and how to decolonize Thanksgiving.
A professional living, how can money justify the greed?
Join KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater for our monthly movie screening night. This month, KBOO proudly presents Alice's Restaurant, the film based on a song based on Arlo Guthrie's 1965 Thanksgiving Day. Alice's Restaurant will screen Wednesday, November 26th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information about the film at KBOO at the Clinton Street.